Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is June 26th, and in Parshas Tzav, we're up to page 578. Pasuk Chavches, verse 28. Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lemor, Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, Daber al Bnei Yisrael Lemor, speak to the Bnei Yisrael, saying, Hamakrib ezevach shlamav laHashem, the one who is offering the shlamim karbon to Hashem, Yavias karbono laHashem, izevach shlamav, shall bring his karbon to Hashem from his shlamim, from his karbon shlamim. So, meaning that the person brings his own, that the owner of the carbon brings it to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, he's going to be involved in something else. We learned before that the first step in any carbon, which is an animal, is shechita, is slaughtering the animal. That can be done by anybody. It does not have to be a Kohen who does that service. However, afterwards it must be a Kohen. A Kohen has to catch the blood, a Kohen has to throw the blood, a Kohen has to burn whatever has to be burned on the Mizbeach. But there is one more step in which the owner of the Shlamim, the one who is actually offering it, has to be involved. And that is the following. Yadav tivyena esi shei Hashem. His hands shall bring it, that which is the fire offering to Hashem. Es hachelev al hechazeh yivyenu. The fats on the chest, he shall bring it. Eis hachazeh, the chest, lahanif oso, to wave it, tinufar lifnei Hashem, as a waving in front of Hashem. Now, the shlamim, the carbon shlamim, along with many of the other carbonos of the Beis HaMikdash, require waving. And we say the word waving, I'm not sure that everybody understands what it is. I'm not even sure it's the right translation. What do they use?
Waving.
Right. I don't know if it's the correct translation to use the word waving. However, we are all used to this concept from Lulav and Esrog. What we do with the Lulav and Esrog is what the Gemara calls na'anuim, which is we call shaking. But that is the same process as the waving. The waving is you take the item and then you move it in all four directions and up and down. So, like with the Lulav and Esrog, we go to the front, to the right, to the back, to the left, up and down. So we're doing all six directions, we're waving the item in that direction. And that's the same thing that's done with many of the karbanos, including, as we're about to see, parts of the shlamim. And so it's described over here in the Torah. This waving, the Gemara tells us in regard to the Lulav and Esrog, and in some other situations, the Gemara says that the purpose of the waving, or the symbolism of the waving, is that we are moving it in every direction, because we're showing that every direction is in the control of Hashem. But the Gemara says specifically with the Lulav and Esrog that it is to Latsar ruchos ros utlolim roim, that it is to prevent evil winds and bad dew, meaning various types of elemental issues, whether it's the bad weather or those sorts of things, that the waving is meant to dedicate ourselves in all directions, and it's meant to withstand any terrible winds that would come from any of the four directions, or from above and below, we refer to the dew or the rains and that sort of thing. So the waving is meant to be a zchus, to be a merit for things that come from all of these directions. And that's true with the Lulav and Esrog. It does not say specifically over here the same concept, but it would seem to be the same idea that that's what the waving is. Now, waving is not only done over here, it is done with Bikurim, for example. It is done with a mincha. Many of the karbanos, there's waving that is done. And it's all the same type of waving.
It's always in the six directions.
It's always in the six directions. The directions that we go, the typical custom with the Lulav and Esrog is the way I said it, which is they go forward, to the right, to the back, to the left, and then up and then down. Some have a little bit of a different configuration, where they move in different directions in figuring it out. No matter what custom anybody has, we are always careful, of course, not to do anything that would resemble a cross. That for sure we do not do. But we do all six directions in one way or another. Now, in the case of the shlamim, the owner of the shlamim has to be involved in the waving. So the owner has to put his hands underneath the part that has to be waved. The kohen also has to wave the parts of the animal need to be waved. So the kohen puts his hands underneath the hands of the owner. So the owner puts his hands under the item, and then the kohen has his hands underneath the hands of the owner, and then together in unison they wave it, however it's supposed to be waved.
But they're facing each other.
Right? I imagine so.
So who's up and down? Is it?
Well, up and down is always the same.
Okay, fine.
Yeah. I mean, I was just standing on your head.
Right. So about the other direction?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. So here, what it says is, Yadav to Vienna, in Pasuk Lamed, verse 30, his hands, meaning the owner's hands, shall bring it, Esi Shei Hashem, that which has to be burned to Hashem, Es HaChelev Al HaChazeh Yivienu, the fats on top of the chest, he shall bring it. Eis hechazeh, the fats are lahanifa so tenufa lifnei Hashem, are to be waved for Hashem, not to be burned. The Torah is making a distinction that the chest is not burned. The chest is put together with the fats for the waving, but it is not burned. And the next pasuk tells us, v'hiktira kohen es achelav hamizbecha, the kohen then burns the fats on the mizbeach, on the altar, v'hayah hechazeh, Le'aron u'levanav, but the chest goes to Aaron and to his children. Now, there are some curiosities in the way that the Torah describes these fats and the other parts that are being waved. We've already discussed which fats they are, even though we never went through specifically with the anatomy of a cow or a sheep or a goat. Only because I could do that with you, but I would be still as much in the dark as anybody is now. It doesn't elucidate it for me at all. So, but there are various fats that have to get burned. Now, the pasuk over here says, "Es hachelev al hachazeh yivienu," the fats on top of the chest, he shall bring it. Now, there are two other psukim, not over here, but there are two other psukim that seem to say it slightly differently. Later on, you can look if you want. You don't need to look ahead, but if you'd like to look ahead, if you'd like to look ahead on page 594, it says in Pasuk Tes Vav, in verse 15, it says, Shokatruma v'chazeya tenufa, now here it includes also the back leg of the animal, which we have not mentioned yet. We'll get to that soon.
Pasuk
Tes Vav 15. Okay. The leg of the leg that has been separated and the chest of waving, Al Ishea Chalavim Yavu, should be brought on top of the fats that are to be burned. So here it places the chest over the fats, where in our pasuk it puts the fats over the chest. And one more pasuk, which is a little earlier than that, it's on page 590. in Pasuk Chaf in verse 20. It says, "Vayasimu es hachalavim al hechazos." They placed the fats on the chest. "Vayatira hachalavim amizbecha," and they burned the fats on the altar. So, and here again, it puts the fats on top of the chest. So we have two psukim that indicate that the fats are on top, and then we have two psukim indicating, and one pasuk indicating that the chest is on top. Now, in the way that the animal is first skinned and cut up, the natural thing would be that the fats are on top of the chest. So the Kohen who is taking those items from the Beis HaMitbachayim, from the area where the animal has been skinned and cut up, he's going to slip his hands underneath the large, whatever this portion of the animal, which is going to be the fats on top, and on bottom will be the chest, and he will lift it up and bring it to where the owner of the animal and another Kohen will wave it. So then now, how do you get it from one person's hands to another? So what you do is, the person is going to take this is a large piece of meat and fat, so that what you're going to do is, you're going to put your hands on top, and then, well, I guess you're going to do it, it's kind of how you're going to do it, not exactly sure how you're going to, what's going to happen is, they're going to flip it over, so that, what's that?
Kind of like deposit it the way you in it all.
Yeah, you're gonna flip it onto the next person's hands. Yeah. So therefore, what used to be on top is going to end up on bottom. What used to be on bottom is going to end up on top. Oh. So therefore, for the waving, the fats which used to be on top will now be on the bottom, and the chest which used to be on the bottom will now be on the top. Then after the waving, then the fats need to be burned. The chest is going to go to the Kohen to eat. So now it has to be given to the next person. So now again, it's going to be flipped another time. So there's going to be three different Kohanim involved in this process. You're going to have the Kohen who's going to bring the fats and the chest from the place where it was skinned and cut up. That's going to be deposited into the hands of the owner of the Karbon and another Kohen, who are together going to wave the animal. Then from there will be deposited into the hands of a third Kohen who will take it to the Mizbech, to the altar, where whatever needs to be burned will be burned, whatever needs to be given to the Kohen to eat will be given to the Kohen to eat. Why should you have so many people involved? So the Gemara tells us, Berov Am Hadras Melech, that when with Berov Am, when there's a multitude of people, Hadras Melech, that is the glory of the king. So the more people involved in the process of the karbon, the better it is. This is not required if there is only one Kohen working in the Beis HaMikdash, which would be rare. But if in the event that there would only be one, he could do it by himself. You wouldn't need another Kohen or another two Kohanim. However, it is better to do it this way because the more who are involved, the better. We have certain halachos that are actually in practice today because of this concept of Berov Am Hadras Melech, that with a multitude of the nation, it is the glory of the king. For this reason, on Purim, to listen to the Megillah, it is not required to have a minyan for the listening to the Megillah. You can hear the Megillah in the privacy of your own home, and you only need one other person to read it to. You don't need to have a minyan, that you don't have to daven, just listen to the Megillah. However, the halacha is that if you can come to shul, you should come to shul because of Berov Am Hadras Melech, because the more people who are involved, it is the glory of the king. So there's an example where even though it doesn't require a shul, it doesn't require a minyan, nevertheless, it is best to do it that way because of Berov Am, because of this concept of the more people, the greater the glory of the king. So here, with the waving of the fats and the chest of the animal, we involve as many Kohanim as we can. In this case, it will take three separate Kohanim in order to do this process. Now, we only mentioned the chest. We did not mention the back right leg. And that's mentioned in the next Pasuk, back on page 578. Pasuk Lamed Vayis, verse 32. Ve'es shel hayamin, and the right back leg, titnu sumah la'kohen, should be given as teruma for the kohen, mizivchei shameichem, from your peace offerings, from your shlamim karbanos. The word teruma we typically use when we talk about grain, that the part of the grain that is separated and given to the kohen is called teruma. The part given to the levi is called meiser, which the word tithe really means a tenth. That's referring to meiser. Truma is not a tenth. It's not 10%. It's actually 2%. And that's what's given to the kohen. And that's called teruma. But the word teruma doesn't mean grain. It doesn't even mean kohen. Teruma just means that which has been lifted up. Liharim means to lift up. Teruma means that which has been lifted up. Lifted up doesn't have to be literal. It could be just conceptual, but it means it has been elevated. So the status of the grain when you separate it to give to the kohen has been elevated. It becomes teruma. So here, this is another one of the things which are given to the kohen. It is the back right leg of the animal, and it is also called a teruma. Base shok hayamin titnu siruma la kohen, and the back right leg you should give to the kohen as a teruma, that which has been lifted up or elevated, mizivchei shameichem, from your shlamim sacrifices. The shlamim is going to be eaten by the owner of the sacrifice. It is not eaten by the kohen. The shlamim is kadshim kalim, which is the lower tier of kadshim, the lower tier of sanctified karbanos. Unlike the chatas, which is only eaten by the kohen, or the asham, which is only eaten by the kohen, or the mincha, which is only eaten by the kohen, but the shlamim is eaten by the Yisrael, by the owner of the animal. Therefore, when the parts that are given to the kohen, you're giving up. Now, it's really, you're bringing this whole animal. The animal is full of meat. Certain parts have to get burned on the altar, and they're not kosher, but the rest of it, you're going to eat. You're going to make a feast. You're going to invite people. And you're going to make a big party. So that which you give to the kohen, you are giving up. And what parts of the animal must be given to the kohen? They are the chazeh, which is the chest of the animal, and the shok, the back right leg. Those two parts go to the kohen. And that is a rule that all karbanos that are eaten by... No, I'll take that back. Not all karbanos, but all of the shlamim karbanos, these two parts go to the kohen. In the waving of the animal, only the chest was mentioned, but the truth is that the leg also gets waved. We learn that from a pasuk later on in the Chumash, that also gets waved. It's just not connected to the fats. So it's brought separately, and it's also waved. So those two parts go to the kohen, as we'll see in a moment. Now, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, verse 33, which Kohanim get these parts? So the Pasuk says, Hamakrives dama shlamim vesachelev mi b'nei Aaron, the one who brings the blood of the shlamim and the fats from the sons of Aaron, lo siya shokayamin lemana, to him will be the back right leg as a portion. So this Pasuk appears to be saying that the particular kohen who is processing this particular karban gets the back right leg. But the Gemara tells us that that is not so. The pasuk does not mean that only the kohen who is processing this particular karban gets these portions. Rather, what it means is a kohen who is fit to process the karban gets a portion. So any kohen who is fit to do the service is the one who gets this portion. So who is not fit? A kohen who is tamei, for example, is not fit. If he is tamei at the time that they're processing the karban, then he does not get a portion. But any kohen who is working in the Beis HaMikdash at that time, it's his shift, and he is able to process the carbon, even if he's not needed and therefore is not doing it, he also gets a portion. So they take the chazeh, the chest, and the shok, the back right leg, and it is divided up amongst those kohanim who are fit to serve at the time of the processing of the carbon.
Is that the part that we don't eat?
No, that we would normally eat these parts. You're just saying because it's the back right leg?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's only because in America we don't commercially sell it, only because the process of trebring it, of getting rid of the giranasha, the sciatic nerve, and then the other parts that we don't eat. It's commercial. It has not until now been commercially viable for someone to, because it's so labor intensive to take care of it. It is. Financially better for whoever is dealing with the meat, whoever owns the slaughterhouse, to sell it to the non-Jews as non-kosher meat. In Israel, you can get it. And I would imagine that it won't be so much long down the future when you'll be able to get it here in America too, because I imagine it'll become financially viable.
Sirloin,
yeah. Yeah. That's right. The hindquarters, right now, the way it works in America is just that the hindquarters of the animal are just immediately given to or sold to a non-kosher meat processing plant. That's the immediate way it works. In fact, in the slaughterhouses in America, most of them, I think all of them, are actually connected to a non-kosher slaughterhouse. In the one that I when I was studying these laws, and I don't want to say I was certified, because I never actually learned how to actually do the shechita. I only studied it. I didn't actually do it. But where I went to see it in action, that the kosher slaughtering is actually a part of a larger non-kosher slaughterhouse. It's actually a non-kosher slaughterhouse, of which a small part of it is a kosher slaughterhouse. The reason why they do that is because it's not uncommon for the animal to be completely not kosher, even after they slaughter it. They could discover a hole in the lung, which means it's not kosher. They could discover that the slaughtering wasn't done exactly right. And it's after they slaughter it, they look and they see they didn't do it exactly right. So then it's not kosher. The whole animal is not kosher. So they need to have a way of easily not losing money on the deal and being able to send it off to a non-kosher meat processing. So they're always connected to a non-kosher slaughterhouse. Here, but the back right leg is technically kosher if it would be trabered properly, if we process properly, and you'd pull out the veins you have to pull out, whatever the arteries, whatever has to be taken out of there, then it would be kosher, and that part is given to the kohen. Now, on a typical day in the Beis Hamikdash, you could have hundreds or thousands of karbanos being processed, depending on what's going on. Different things can be happening on a different day. So commensurately, you're also going to have many, many Kohanim at work on a particular day. The Kohanim, hopefully, are going to be in size, are going to be proportional to the size of the Jewish people. And the more Jews you have, the more Karbanos are going to be offered. The more Jews you have, the more Kohanim you have on any given day working in the Beis Hamikdash, even though they're divided up into 24 shifts. But those 24 shifts also grow as the Jewish people grow. And so you could have hundreds of Kohanim working on a particular day. So these pieces of meat, the back right leg and the chest, they need to be eaten by the Kohanim. They have a deadline, just like a regular shlamim has a deadline. You can eat the shlamim the day that it is offered, the following evening, and the next day. So you have 36 hours to eat that meat. So at some point, the Kohanim have to sit down for lunch or dinner or whatever it is, and this is what they're going to eat, along with the mincha that they have to eat, the flour offerings they have to eat. The food they're going to eat while they're working in the Beis HaMikdash is going to be Beis HaMikdash food, because that's what they have to eat it.
How many sacrifices do they do in one day, though?
It could be hundreds or thousands. It could be depending on.
So they have to eat all this food. I
mean, yeah, but there's that many people too. It's one Kohen eating hundreds of, right? Yeah, right. No, so but yes, the Kohen would have to eat it. If it's not eaten in the proper time, it has to get burned. It's leftover. It's no good. It's no sar. So the Kohanim are going to be eating this. So here it's just telling you that the Kohanim who are eligible to eat are the Kohanim who are fit to serve at the time that the carbon is processed. I imagine, even though I don't know exactly how it worked, I imagine that there were the Kohanim, on their shift of their day, themselves were divided up into shifts. That some worked in the morning, and some worked in the afternoon, and some worked in the evening. And when you weren't working, you sat down to eat. And they had the pieces being cooked or being roasted, or whatever they were going to do to eat it. And then they would sit down to their meal, and the meal would consist primarily of these things. Now, they could eat other things with the meat. It didn't have to be just this.
They could
have vegetables. They could have... Yeah. They could. But there was a lot of meat to eat, and there was a lot of flour to eat. I mean, loaves, you know.
A lot of gout.
It's just for a week. Just for a week. So, yeah.
What are the wives and children of the Kohanim? So
depends on what it is. Certain things could only be eaten by the male Kohanim.
Yes.
Certain things could be shared with their families. It depended on what. So that depended. And again, that which had to be eaten only by the Kohanim could only be eaten in the Beis HaMikdash.
Right.
Those things that could be eaten by their families could be eaten in the entire old city of Yerushalayim, which is probably where they lodged while their husbands were working. So yes, they could eat it also, but they had to be tahar, they had to be pure. So that was another limitation, depending on who was pure and who wasn't. So any kohen had to have various types of food because not everybody in his family was going to be tahar at the same time, necessarily.
Yeah.
Now These two parts are given to the Kohen, and it's given to, as I said, any Kohen that is fit to serve at that time. This is an important point because it can be confusing. A Kohen could be Tameh, could be impure at the time of the processing of the Karban, but then by nightfall become Tahar. He might go to the mikvah, and then the sun sets, and at night he is Tahar. So when the Kohanim are sitting down to eat the food, he is already tahor, he's pure. But since he was impure at the time that the carbon was processed, he cannot partake of that food. So not only, as we talked in the past about knowing, it was important to know which carbon came from which person, they had to have some sort of a labeling system, and to know who was bringing what, and whether this was this supposed to be an Ola, or was this supposed to be a Shlomim? What is it supposed to be? They have to know what it's supposed to be. Each Kohen would have to know what they're dealing with. But in addition, when they sat down to eat, the food itself had to be labeled to know, is this food from today? Is this food from yesterday? When is this from? So that whoever was going to sit down to eat it, if a Kohen was Tama yesterday, but it's Tahar today, he can't eat yesterday's food, but he could eat today's food. So there had to be some process in place. There had to be a great deal of organization in how the Beis HaMikdash was run, which you would expect if you have a large facility and there's a lot going on. You're going to have some method of organization. The method is not dictated by the Torah. The method is whatever method the Kohanim wanted to use, they could use. And if in the future it's going to be somehow using technology to work that out, that would be fine. The Torah doesn't tell us how to keep it organized. But it's obvious they had to keep it organized. Pasuk Lamed Aleph, verse 34. Ki es chazei hatenufa ve'es shok hatruma, because the chest, I keep saying chest, they say the breast, okay, of waving, and the leg of the that was elevated, what do they call it?
Raising up.
Okay. It's no better than what I'm doing. Lakachti me'es b'nei Yisrael, I have taken from the Jews, mizivchei shalmehem, from their Shlomim sacrifices, va'ateno sam le'aron ha'kohen, and I have given them to Aaron the Kohen, ulevanav, to his sons, l'chok olam, as a statute forever, me'es b'nei Yisrael, from the b'nei Yisrael. Now one more point. Yes, I'm gonna read further, but I just want to stop here for a moment. Back in Pasuk Lamed Aleph in 31, it says that the Kohen would burn the fats. And then after that, it says in both in the next few psukim, the next few verses, what you give to Aaron to his sons to eat. So the Gemara tells us, Aaron and his sons were not allowed to eat until the parts that were supposed to be burned were burned. What is happening here with a shlamim, which is called a peace offering, but the word shalim also means whole, complete. The shlamim has a portion that is eaten by the kohen, it has a portion that is eaten by the owner, by the one bringing the karban, and it has a portion which is being burned on the altar, which is, so to speak, going to God. Obviously, God doesn't eat anything, but it is, so to speak, being given to God. So you have all three elements being satisfied. The altar gets, the kohen gets, and the person offering it gets. So the order is that order. First, the mizbeach, first the altar, has to be satisfied. You have to burn it on the altar first. Until you burn what has to be burned on the altar, nothing can be eaten by the kohen or by the Yisrael. Now, it doesn't have to be completely consumed on the altar. It could take time to burn. But it has to go up there and be put on the fire prior to the Yisrael, prior to the kohen eating from his portion. And then the kohen can eat from his portion, and then the Yisrael, and the Yisrael can eat from his portion as well.
The portion they ate was cooked, not on the altar.
No, not on the altar.
No.
No. They had various cooking areas scattered throughout the Beis HaMikdash and the courtyard. There were various places to cook. They had all kinds of fire pits and, you know. I don't know, but they had various places to cook. Yeah.
Right. Now you use the term Yisrael. What about the Levim?
Yeah, the Levim in this case would be lumped together with Yisrael.
Okay.
In this case. Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes you find the Levim with the Kohanim, sometimes you find them with Israel. In this case, they're with Israel. Yeah. Now, the eating of the Kohanim is important. We learned before that for those karbanos that offer atonement, like a chatas or an asham, there is no atonement. Well, I shouldn't say there's no atonement. The process of the two primary ways that atonement is achieved through the karban is, even that's not correct. The two primary processes in the karban that offer atonement are the throwing of the blood on the altar. That's the main one. If that doesn't happen, then the whole karban is null and void. If that happens, then the karban is kosher, no matter what happens after that. But the other process that is important for kapara, for atonement, is the consumption by the kohanim. It says, kohanim ochlim ubailim miskaprim. The Kohanim consume and the owners receive atonement. Their consumption is what offers atonement to the owner. It's not integral. In other words, if the blood were thrown properly and then the carbon somehow was destroyed or lost or whatever it was, something happened to mess up the carbon is still kosher and the person is Yotze. He has fulfilled his obligation. But the Kohanim's consumption is nevertheless important for atonement.
And his thoughts.
Yeah, the thoughts, we learned that before. Yes, what they're thinking is of course very important. Right. Okay. Now, Pasuk Lamed Hey, 35. Zos Mishchas Aaron Mishchas Banav Meishei Hashem. This is, now the word Mishchas is a little difficult to translate. They say the anointment, which is what I would have said, except that, this is literally the anointment of Aaron, the anointment of his sons, that does not really capture it, from the fire offerings of Hashem, biyomi krivo sam lechahim la Hashem, on the day that he brought them to become kohanim to Hashem. Mishcha does mean to anoint, like pouring oil on somebody, that is mishcha. Here, it's really being used to mean elevated. This is the way that they were elevated in being brought, when they were being made into Kohanim for Hashem. The way that the karbanos are eaten by the Kohen, later on it's going to say that Hashem gave it to the Kohen, limashcha, same word, literally means for anointment, but it's not really anointment, it means for elevation. Hashem gave it to the Kohanim for, like the word Mashiach, same word, Messiah, Mashiach, and same word means to be anointed. So it means elevated, to be made important. So Hashem gave this food to the Kohanim, Lim Mashcha, for importance. So there is a dispute, therefore, in what way the meat has to be prepared for the Kohanim to eat it. There is an opinion that holds that what is considered to be the most royal, kingly way of eating meat, that would be to roast it over a fire. Why is that the most royal way? And that's the way we eat the Karban Pesach on Pesach. Today we don't do it. Today we have the matzah instead for the afikoman. But in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, we're required to roast the Karban Pesach. It can only be tzli. And the reason why that's considered royal is because people who don't have a lot of money, they have to make the food last as long as possible. Roasting over a fire is the least economical way of preparing your food. You get no liquid out of it. The fats drip away. You lose a lot in the roasting process. The most economical way is to boil it. You boil in water, you get the soup out of it, you can get the marrow out of the bones. There's a lot that you can get. You can make it last a lot longer. A chalent is really a poor man's food. It's to make it last a lot longer. You put other things in there, it picks up the taste of the meat, and you can really make it more than what you have. You have a little bit of meat, you add a bunch of other stuff, you get a nice stew, so it tastes good, and you make it last longer. But someone who is royal, where money is no object, so then roasting is tasty, and it pays no attention to the fact that it's not lasting very long. So there is an opinion that says that just as we are required to roast the Karban Pesach, so too the Kohanim had to roast the meat that they eat. But that is not how we rule. We rule that they could prepare the meat however they wished. And so could the owner of the Shlamim. So it did not have to be roasted. This could be boiled or whatever, or however you wanted to prepare your meat. You were allowed to do so for the shlamim and the kohanim also. You can eat it however you wanted to.
Is there a time limit by which you had to eat it?
Yes, you only had the day was brought, the following night, and the next day.
Okay.
It was a 36-hour maximum 36 hours. Gotcha. to eat the shlamim. As I mentioned before, it became almost like a party. You invited people to eat. You could feed it to your family, and you invited people to eat. Again, only people who were tahor, who were pure, were allowed to eat from the karban. So you brought it at a time when you felt that the maximum amount of people were going to be tahor to eat from the meat. Pasuk Lamed Vav, verse 36. Asher tziva Hashem laseis lahem biyom mashcho osam. This is what Hashem commanded to give to them, to give to the Kohanim. On the day that He anointed them, me'eis b'nei Yisrael, from the Jewish people, chukas olam l'dor osam, a law forever for all their generations. Zos ha-Torah la'ula la'mincha v'la'chatas v'la'asham. This is the Torah, which means the law, for the ola. That's the burnt offering. For the mincha, that's the flour offering, the meal offering. V'la chatas v'la asham, two different types of sin offerings. V'la milu'im, the milu'im are the special offerings that we're going to describe actually starting next time, which are the offerings for the inauguration of the mizbeach, of the altar, and of the kohanim. Ulezevach haShlamim, and for the carbon of Shlamim, the peace offerings. Asher tziva Hashem es Moshe b'Har Sinai, that Hashem commanded Moshe on Har Sinai, biyom tzavoso es b'nei Yisrael, on the day that He commanded the Jewish people, lahakrives karbanehem laHashem, to bring their offerings to Hashem, b'midbar Sinai, in the wilderness of Sinai. When it says in Pasuk Lamed Zion 37, this is the law, la'ola la'mincha v'la'chatas v'la'asham, so the way that it's read, la'ola, you could, and if you were to read it a little bit, you could break it down to la'ola, or la mincha, la chatas. You find in many places in the Gemara that the prefix la or la, which means la is two or four, that's what it means. But from a midrashic standpoint, it can also mean not or no, like lo ola, lo mincha, not an ola, not a mincha. So the Gemara says that we are to understand this, Zos HaTorah, if someone is involved in the study of Torah, lo ola, lo mincha, lo chatas, lo asham, it is not necessary for him to offer a karban ola or mincha or chatas or asham or any other karbanos. That the study of Torah has the power to take the place of these karbanos. And therefore today, where we do not have a Beis HaMikdash, we don't have a temple, we're not able to offer these karbanos, so what would be the substitute? Now we know the direct substitute is, what's the direct substitute of karbanos?
Yeah.
Is davening. Davening is the direct substitute. And that is what we do 3 times a day in order to make up for the fact that we are not offering karbanos. However, the study of Torah also has the capacity to protect a person in the event that they really are required to bring one of these karbanos and can't, because we can't do it today, the study of Torah will in some way make up for that. So, gezunt. In addition, the Gemara tells us, kol ha'osek b'toras ola, anybody who is involved in the laws of Ola, ki'ilu hikriv Ola, it's as if he brought the Ola. V'chol ha'osek b'toras mincha, anybody who is involved in the laws of the karban mincha, it's as if he brought a karban mincha. Studying the laws of these karbanos makes it as if we are actually offering these karbanos. When we study Torah, it is not necessary for the study of Torah to be practical, meaning that the study of Torah stands on its own as a mitzvah, and it is a mitzvah whether or not there's a practical application. And therefore, the study of Torah includes all areas of Torah, even those areas that are not relevant today. We can't bring karbanos today, yet we study this part of the Torah. We don't have most of the laws of tumah and tara, of purity and impurity, most of them, except for family purity, we don't really have today, yet we study them anyway. Many of the agricultural laws, even for those living in Israel, not all of them apply today. Certainly living outside of Israel, much of them do not apply today. Yet we study them anyway. The laws of the Beis HaMikdash, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. The laws of kings, these things are things that are not relevant today, although we hope to become relevant very quickly, but as we stand, they're not relevant. Nevertheless, we study them. It is not necessary for the mitzvah of the study of Torah, of Talmud Torah, the mitzvah does not mandate that what we study be practical. It is important that we study with intention to do what we learn. Lilmod almanas lasos, to study on condition to perform. So that if we do come across something that is relevant, we have to have intention to fulfill that which we study. We didn't know it until now. Now we discover it. Okay, we discovered it. It's the Torah. We got to do it. But a lot of it today is not relevant. That does not diminish the mitzvah of the study of Torah. But when it comes to karbanos, even that which doesn't appear to be relevant really is relevant. Because since we can't offer the karbanos, the Gemara says the study of the karban is like we offered a karban. Now these past number of weeks, really months, we've been studying the laws of these karbanos, and we're beginning into the details, and Doreen keeps saying to me, why this, why that, why, right? So we have all these intricacies and all these complexities of the laws, and even though we're not doing them, we're not performing them, and the truth is, a lot of this, even after the Beis HaMikdash is built, please God, it'll be built tomorrow, a lot of this will not be relevant directly to perhaps all of us. Is anybody here a Kohen? You a Kohen? Kohen? Anybody a Kohen? I'm not either. So none of us are actually going to do a lot of the things we're studying. There will be Kohanim who are doing it, but a lot of us are not going to be doing it ourselves. Nevertheless, by studying them, it is as if we have offered these karbanos. That's a very, very significant thing. And when we live in a time where we can't bring karbanos, and the karbanos are so important for our connection to Hashem and for our ability to achieve atonement, then by studying it, we do get those. We do get that at least that benefit of having been as if we've actually brought the karban. The Chafetz Chaim writes, fascinatingly, the Chafetz Chaim writes that, you know, there are 6 sections in the Mishnah. There's 6 different sections. There's I'll go in the order of the Mishnah. There's Zerayim, which is the agricultural laws. Then there's Moed, which are the holidays and Shabbos. And then there's Nashim, which are the laws of marriage and divorce, and Ksuba. And then there is Nizikin, that's damages, torts, those sorts of things, financial laws. Then there is Kadshim, which is the laws of the Beis HaMikdash and the Karbanos. And then there's Taros, which is the laws of purity and impurity. Six sections. So of these six sections, three are relevant. Most of what is learned is relevant. And three, much of it is not relevant today. The laws of the holidays and Shabbos are obviously relevant today. The laws of marriage, divorce, ksuba, most of that is relevant today. And the laws of damages, financial, money laws, those are relevant today. Those three sections, Moed, Nashim, Nezikim, are all very, very relevant. The other three, Zraim, agricultural laws, and Kadshim, the Beis HaMikdash laws, and Tumah and Tara, the purity and impurity, are largely not relevant today. The Chafetz Chaim proves that throughout the centuries, the Torah scholars were always proficient in at least four sections of the Mishnah. The three that are relevant, of course, that's Moed, the holidays, Nashim, marriage and divorce, and Ezekiel, financial laws. And the fourth one that they were always proficient in is the laws of the Beis HaMikdash. They weren't so proficient in the laws of agricultural and the laws of Tumah and Tara, of purity and impurity, but the laws of Kadshim, of the Beis HaMikdash, of Karbanos, they were always proficient in. You know that the Mishnayos include all six of these sections, but the Gemara, the Talmud, the Gemara, we've lost a lot of the Gemara. We don't have the Gemara on many of the tractates. We have on the three that are relevant today, and then we have only in the agricultural laws, we only have one of them, which is Brachos, which obviously is relevant, and in Taros, in the laws of purity and impurity, all we have is Nida, which is family purity. We don't have the rest of them. In Kunshim, in the laws of the Beis HaMikdash, we have all the Gemaras, or almost all the Gemaras. There we do, because of what the Chafetz Chaim is saying, that the Torah scholars were always proficient in these laws. So he says, why is that so? He himself was a Kohen, the Chafetz Chaim. His name was Kagan, and he encouraged Talmidei Chachamim, Torah scholars, to study these laws just as well and just as proficiently as they study the other ones. So why, he says? So he says, because Mehera Yibana Beis HaMikdash, we hope and pray the Beis HaMikdash should be rebuilt speedily and in our days, and when it's rebuilt, we're going to have to know what to do right away. The Beis HaMikdash is going to be built very quickly, this third one. The first two had to be built by flesh and blood. It took a long time. But the third one, we are guaranteed that it's going to happen very quickly. So once it goes up, it has to be used. And we have to know these laws. So the Chafetz Chaim says, so you'll argue, if you're a Torah scholar, you'll say, well, I'm not a Kohen, so I'm not going to need to know. So he says, who do you think they're going to ask? Today, when someone has a question, whether something's permitted on Shabbos or not, whether something is kosher or not, what do? They go to the rabbi. Well, what are they going to do in the Beis HaMikdash? They're going to have this Beis HaMikdash. They're going to go to work. They're not going to know what to do. They're going to go to the rabbi. So, rabbi, you better know how to answer these questions. So the Chafetz Chaim writes, but one second. When the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, we are also told we're going to have some pretty special people who are going to rejoin us. One of them in particular is Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah. He's supposed to rejoin us at that time and be with us. So, you got a good rabbi to ask questions to. In fact, very often the Gemara ends off, when the Gemara goes to a discussion and is unable to arrive at a conclusion, the Gemara will end off with the word teku. Teku means let it stand, which means we don't know the answer, so we'll let the question stand. Sometimes we don't know all the answers, so we just have to say teku. We just don't know the answer. The question stands. Teku. It's an Aramaic word, which means let it stand. Tuf yud kuf vav. Teku. But there are those who say that tuf yud kuf vav is actually not an acronym. What do you say when it's a... each letter stands for something. It's not
an acronym.
I guess it's an acronym. I think an acronym is a little bit. Okay, but anyway, so that it stands for tough as Tishbi. Tishbi is Eliyahu. Tishbi. Yitarets, he will answer. Kushyos va'abayos, questions and queries. He'll answer the questions. So when Mashiach comes and we have Eliyahu Navi, he will answer our questions that we have let stand that we don't know the answer to. That's one of the ways of dealing with those unanswered questions. The truth is Mashiach himself is going to be a huge Torah scholar and will also be able to answer a lot of the questions. So the Chafetz Chaim writes, so perhaps you, the Torah scholar, you'll say to me, well, I don't need to know the answers to these questions because I only need to know what's relevant today, because today we don't have Eliyahu HaNavi here. But when the Beis HaMikdash is built, they're not going to come to me, they're going to go to Eliyahu HaNavi. Says the Chafetz Chaim, I don't know how he knows this, but says the Chafetz Chaim, the only answers that Eliyahu was going to give us are those answers that were not able to be found by us. No, it's those things that were unanswered.
We don't know.
But those things which are somewhere in the Gemara, and you, because of your deficiency, didn't study it, he's going to say to you, what are you asking me for? It's in the Gemara. Go learn it. So the Chafetz Chaim says, make sure, so you don't get embarrassed when Mashiach comes, make sure if you're a rabbi, you know these laws too. And don't rely on the fact that they're not relevant or the fact that someone else is going to be there to answer the questions. Make sure you're just as proficient in these laws as you are in the other laws as well. And he proves that throughout the generations, it's true that the Torah scholars were proficient in these laws just as much as they were in the laws that are quote-unquote relevant. These laws as well, they were proficient in. Yeah.
Do we know that the Gemara did exist for those other sections that we no longer have it?
Yeah, first of all, the Yerushalmi
has it.
We have more from the Yerushalmi than we have from the Bavli. The Yerushalmi is shorter than the Bavli, but that we do have, particularly on Zerayim, on the agricultural laws, because it was in Israel. Mm-hmm. So there is Yerushalmi on a lot of those sections, and also it seems from certain discussions in the Gemara that there were Gemaras on those. Gemara just means the discussions of the sages about the Mishnah.
Right.
After the Mishnah was committed to writing, the discussions that ensued following the Mishnah for the next 300 or so years, that's the Gemara. So whatever, when they studied those parts, they also had discussions. They just never got put into our Gemara, our Talmud Bavli.
Were they recorded, but we've lost the manuscripts, or they were not recorded?
The question is, were they redacted?
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know that they were put together into a formal text. They probably
might not have happened.
They probably were not redacted. That's right. They probably were not redacted.
Which means we cannot look forward maybe to the discovery of the manuscript.
Right. Right. That's right. There wouldn't be any you know Talmud that they'll find from someplace. They might find some person's personal notes, which is what really the Gemara was taken from. There were notes that each of the sages had, and then Ravina and Ravashi put it together to form the Talmud. Right.
And discussions that happen now, are they written, or?
You mean right now?
There's just nothing new.
No. I mean, people write all kinds of. I mean, now there's a plethora of books. I mean, you know, you can find almost, you know, today. It's people formally now that it's the age of books. I mean, there's, you know, well, now we're beyond the age of books. Now it's the electronic age.
Right.
But
I'm in that.
Yeah, that's right. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.